Welcome to Iteration, a weekly podcast about programming, development, and design through the lens of amazing books chapter by chapter. This week, we are doing a book summary and kind of a update on what's going on in the lives of me, John. Hi, I'm John, and joining me, as always, is JP.
Hello.
So the idea today is to kind of shoot the shit about recent projects. Hopefully it's enlightening kind of recent lessons learned and trials and errors, kind of through the lens through our favorite tips, in a way, kind of a book recap, talking through kind of our favorite tips and tricks.
Yes, we'll try very hard to not say service objects way too much and also try very hard not to say... All the usual suspect things that we love talking about, like testing and ubiquitous languages.
And just make it an object. Make it an object. All right. So do you wanna kind of rock through tip by tip? Well, how do you want to do it, JP?
I don't know. I think we should just sort of like reflect and not have a like structured discussion. This is like so interesting because usually I have like a set of things prepared, but we're just sort of going off the cuff here, which is pretty awesome. I think it's going to be fun to talk about like sort of the projects we're working on or just like what we are obligated to work on because we're getting paid to write software.
Sounds good. So how about this? Let's start with what we did today and what we plan to do tomorrow or yesterday, whatever was like recently done and recently doing.
Sick. Yeah, so I can start that off. It's fun. Like right before this call, I was like working on this test that I was trying to get passed. So for me to like take a step back really quick and give you some context of what I was actually working on, I am working on, for open listings, I'm working on a way to make it so that our agents can set their availability. I don't know how much of this stuff is like a secret or whatever. So I'm trying to speak as if it was like, as if I wasn't allowed to talk about this. although I'm sure that I'm being broad enough so that I'm not giving away like too much, I guess.
Any kind of trade secrets. If you work for Zillow, anyone out there, just stop listening.
Okay? Yeah. Zillow, Redfin, Purple Bricks, just turn it off. You're an engineer there. Don't listen to this stuff. It's all fake. But anyways.
So we're good. We covered our ass.
Yeah. But anyways, I'm working on this thing that lets touring agents set their availability. And I have so many tangents to go off of that I've planned on that I was like, oh, this would be fun to talk about. But basically a way for them to set their availability. And there's just so many nuances in it. Because let's say a touring agent goes on holiday for 3 days. And so they're not able to show any tours to people who request them. And now there's all these like edge cases so that like when they change their availability, an email has to shoot off to our support team and it has to notify support team like, hey, such and such, so and so is not available to tour on these days. And then there's like edge cases where if they like set their availability so that they're actually not on holiday anymore, like let's say they like made a mistake and they were like, oh, actually I'm going to be available on those days. Then we have to send an email that says like, hey, so and so is... cleared their holiday schedule or whatever, and now they're able to do this. So now where this gets like kind of hairy is we're not in like Active Record land really. We're in like Mongo land. And so like the data structure for this is like I'm passing in an array of times, and those times are being set against the agent model. And so it just gets, I don't know, I'm having this weird problem right now where this test that I'm working on for some reason, in my like integration tests, when I try to send in an empty array, it's coming in as like nil in the params, which like doesn't make sense to me at all. So like I'm trying to simulate sending an empty array, which is to say that I'm sending in an empty time slot, to say that like, hey, I'm actually not on a holiday anymore. I have no, I'm available. Basically. So this empty array basically says like, hey, there's no days. But for some reason in my tests, that empty array is being passed as a parameter as like nil for some reason, which like makes absolute no sense to me. So that's just what I've been dealing with for the last 2 or 3 hours, which is kind of fun. Not 2 or 3 hours, that's an exaggeration. But I mean, I'll figure something out.
It sounds like one of those super nitpicky things that's just like you can't figure out what bit is flipped in the wrong way that's making your test unhappy.
Yeah, I just have like no idea, and I've been binding dot prying the shit out of this thing, and I I don't know. I'll probably like sleep on it and it'll be like a one liner that I'm like, oh, that's what it was tomorrow. I'm like totally sure.
That's the lesson to take away. And it's one of those things like if one of your base assumptions is wrong, like it's probably just something that you're missing. Like it's not passing nil values by itself. Like you must be doing something in there and something in that chain is being lost.
Yeah, something is coercing it to be nil. Or something. I have no idea. On that note, there's two things I wanted to bring up now that we're talking about this that I thought was really interesting.
Yeah.
So I'm going to go ahead and say it first. Ubiquitous language. So I noticed that I said I had said touring agent. So that is the term that we're using for agents who show tours. But they are also referred to as showing agents. So like touring agent and showing agent can be used interchangeably. And so Okay. Littered in the code base, everything is showing agent, like showing agents controller, showing agents, blah, blah, blah. Even like the text on like the physical, like, or not physical, but the UI says like showing agent, blah, blah, blah. However, we want to change this distinction to now be touring agent. And I was like, oh, hey, ubiquitous language. Because even our customer support team is like, hey, we noticed that it says like showing agent everywhere on the admin dashboard. Can we like change that to say touring agent? Because ops is saying showing agent, marketing's saying showing agent, but like really we should all be saying touring agent. And I was like, oh, dang, that's like, this is like ubiquitous language in the...
Yeah, it's a perfect example of it.
In the mix. Like, it's like a live example of ubiquitous language. And, you know, what I have to say is it is like not... It's not an easy thing to just flip that switch, especially because, like, the thought had crossed my mind, like, oh, in our code base, we should just change everything from showing agent to touring agent.
Yeah, just kind of command F across everything.
Yeah, just command F, find and replace. But, like, the ramifications of that are so, so immense. Like, so much would have to change. That would touch so many different files. I can't even comprehend how that would work. And so I was thinking, like in practice, how are you supposed to do that? And the problem is that now, if we want to ship something and we do change the front end to say touring agent instead of showing agent, now there's this like inherent inconsistency of like the front end code will say touring agent because that's what it's supposed to display. And then, but like the code itself will be saying like showing agent. And so someone who's like coming onto the code base is like someone who's onboarding. Like that's just something that we'd have to like tell them because it'd be like, well, what's the difference between the showing agent and the touring agent? Is there just like a nuance that I'm not understanding or, you know, like what's going on here?
Yeah. Do you feel like it's worth, I mean, is your organization going to take the time to actually refactor all those references in every layer of the code base? Or is it something that's just kind of be a known issue for a while?
I don't know that that's like one really worth the time. Well, is it like important? Yes. But is it like worth the time to stop everything right now and do? It might be like one of those things that it's like, hey, it's Christmas break and there's kind of a lull in activity or I don't know if Christmas break actually has like a lull in activity. That's just like an example.
It's some other time where there's a real estate lull. Yeah.
Yeah. Where it's like, oh, hey, maybe we can like start knocking off things off that laundry list of like code cleanup and like, you know, little things that we've been meaning to change for the longest time. But
yeah.
I don't know. It's like very hard to just like globally change something or like when something like that comes along, I don't know how you're supposed to, you know, handle that because like I can't just all of a sudden start slowly renaming, you know, variables in the code to say touring agent because that'd be even more confusing. Like it makes sense to just like leave like the hard-coded front-end UI things to say touring agent where all the variables still say showing agent because then it'd be like, why are some things named differently?
Least the back end is consistent. Like you might call it something else from a marketing term, which happens in your apps. Not always is your objects the exact, you know, thing that the button says on the front end. So that does happen. And I agree with you. I think at some point the Band-Aid should be pulled off like as consistently as possible in one big sprint to rename all that. If it's worth it. And I think the question is like, is there genuine inefficiencies and miscommunications caused by it not being named consistently? Mm-hmm. At that point, it's probably time to rename it. And it's one of those things like, is this a broken window? Maybe it's like a tinted window. You don't love the tinting color.
I don't know. Is it a broken window? Maybe. I don't think it's a broken window in the sense that like it's not going to have like code rot. But it's definitely something that should eventually be addressed. Because who knows? Maybe touring agent doesn't like stick. And then it would be like, fuck, we changed everything. Change it back.
Right.
But I don't know. We'll have to let that one sit.
I mean, I've done read names before of models that touch a lot of stuff. Your application's obviously an order of magnitude larger than mine. But I just, if you have great test coverage, I started with literally a find and replace across, you know, the capitalized version, the snake case version, just find and replace across everything and then see where the tests are. And I mean, that's where I would start approaching something like that. Just even see what a find and replace does. If you only have 12, 13 failing tests or 20 even, like, there's a path to the future. Like, there's a way to move forward. But, you know, if you've got dozens upon dozens of failing tests, then you kind of know the scope of that kind of a refactor. And then you can kind of make that estimate. Like we even talked about in one of the tips, I don't remember what it was, but make that estimate of what it is, whether it's or not it's worth digging into, like when it is time to refactor. It's tough because it's like not a bug. You're right.
Yeah.
There's nothing wrong with it inherently. It's just kind of not great. It's kind of a code smell. If you had it too much across too many objects, it would definitely be a problem.
Yeah, I think for now, as long as we keep everything to say showing agent, I think it should mostly be okay. And this is like, you know, like what would a pragmatic approach be to that? It would probably just to be like stick to at least one thing. Like keep one thing consistent and it will like eliminate most of the
Yeah, it's funny because I think to some degree you could just kind of have marketing use the different word.
Right.
It'd probably be a week or two of transition and probably a lot less painful than it would be for the backend team to rename it. And if the business side is okay with both names, like maybe it's just touring versus showing, you just pick one. It doesn't really matter. Maybe it's one of those things.
Nice. Yeah, totally.
So I've been working on actually two things. One thing that's really kind of funny to me. So one of them is in one of the startups I work with, this is a very pragmatic approach, if you can call it that. They don't have a way to automatically charge cards. So we have a way to securely store card data into Stripe, but we actually like don't actually have a subscription model, even though you click a button in your account and it says, yes, subscribe me. It just sets a database flag. And so actually today I know it's mid-month, but it's actually when I was processing all of the subscriptions for the month. So I just take like 2.5 hours today, just literally in the Stripe backend charging cards, like in the WYSIWYG interface. Cause like I did a quick back of the napkin, like, is it worth the time at this point to write the code to do that? And it's still like the cost benefit is not there to actually write out the subscription models, especially because my end client is so unsure what subscriptions should look like, you know, when they start, what amounts they should be. And like, there's some of that that can be built into a subscription model, but there's even more like based on how often they pay, or whether they're monthly or quarterly or annually. They have no idea what direction they're going. And right now they're very manually onboarding these different cohorts and these different participants of totally different, like some are paying annually, some are paying 6 months at a time, monthly, and they're still testing everything. And so for now there's just a single column in the database that specifies what type of subscription you have. All the credit card information is securely stored in Stripe. We don't touch that. So that's all over on Stripe. And so it's a matter of a Google sheet, looking up the email address, making sure it's the right amount, charging it, updating the Google spreadsheet and entering the notes into our backend that it's all there. And it's tedious. This is only the second month we've done it, but the business team isn't anywhere near yet deciding what to do. And so to me, to build the wrong thing doesn't make any sense when we're only processing, it's in the dozens of monthly subscriptions we have. It's a very high dollar product, so that's a good amount of revenue, but it's only in the, you know, 3 or 4 dozen type of users that are actually paying users depending on the month. And so it kind of doesn't make sense to me. But today when I was like 2 hours in, it took me like 2.5 hours or so to do. I was like 2 hours into that and I was thinking like, man, this is not in context with the book, but at the same time it is, because it's pragmatic to not build before you know. And so there's some of that element there, but at the same time, like, automate everything was just like resounding in my head. And so I think next time I go about it, I think what I'll do is some kind of CLI, like a command line interface to do it straight to the server versus actually using the WYSIWYG of Stripe. So like maybe it's one method that charges the card and if successful, then appends the notes. So it does like kind of those 2 or 3 steps that I was doing. So it's, you know, it's not a full build out with a UI and everything to handle subscriptions and a new subscription model, but at least it's something to make it a little bit more automated. It's just tough because like they're all over the map from a business perspective on how to charge for the product.
I think that's totally a pragmatic approach to it, because I don't know, I'm sort of like on the wave of like, you should just do something until it hurts. So like,
yeah,
if you built something, it would almost be like prematurely optimizing for like what you're anticipating. But like, sometimes you just gotta like, in order to get shit done, you just have to like do it messy the first time, you know, repeat code, do things manually. Don't like do all these crazy abstractions that are that might end up being wrong. So I think, you know, just a little bit of manual work isn't always bad. I mean, maybe you can like write a couple scripts to automate some of that stuff, and that could be like,
yeah,
that could help your efficiency. But I think that's totally a pragmatic way of doing things. And I mean, like one of the tips that stood out to me in the book is like, start when you're ready. And so it's like, obviously you're not like ready.
Yeah. And I think it's one of those things that's nowhere near from a business side, or they have they defined the problem enough to be able to even begin modeling it from a software perspective. And I could totally pick something and give it to the business team, but I think in a lot of ways I'd be locking them to something long before they're ready. And I know that there's tons of, you know, Stripe even has built-in subscription methods, and there's tons of ways around that and to try to hack something together so that we didn't have to do something manual. But I think for what we're doing now, I think it's the right approach. And I'm kind of like waiting until that threshold, the estimated charges, is like in the 5 or 6 hours, that it doesn't make any sense to keep doing it manually. And I think with scripting, I could bring down like today's work down to like 30 or 40 minutes, because there's kind of three steps that I do, and I can turn it into one step per each user and just do it right from the command line. And then the other thing I was working on is I was reviewing a pull request from someone I work with, reviewing a pull request on this kind of event reminders concept. So we have this concept of upcoming events. It's a very, very basic like event calendar. You just kind of make almost like Facebook style events. So like you pick a date, you add a title in the description, and you kind of invite different participants to participate in this event. They RSVP, pretty straightforward models, but there was only an initial notice of when a new event was created. So like when a new event was created, everybody who's on that RSVP would get a ping, but now we actually have this custom reminder system. So there's an event reminder object, and there's so you can add up to 5 event reminders, and you kind of pick from a dropdown of 21 days in advance, 14 days in advance, 10 days in advance, and it kind of just hard codes. I think there's about 18 different options all the way down to 1 hour before event. I toyed with a lot, and there's a lot to talk about here of just like making it more flexible, of allowing like any types of quantities. So it's like have a integer picker and then an hours, minutes, days picker, so you could pick any quantity. But then when I was workshopping this UI with the client, they're just like, no, I don't need that level of nuance. Like I just kind of need this 12 or so set of options. But then from there, you can kind of add multiple. So you can add up to 5 event reminders, you know, from 30 days out all the way up to an hour before the event. And then you can also pick how they send, so via SMS or via email. And this specific build, I'm super proud of our approach, because it's very, just very cruddy. Like it's create, read, update, destroy. But the thing that's kind of cool is there's a little bit of a generator, kind of a service object that makes those default. So you always, when you create a new event, there's always default reminders, but then you can actually update that to be a new set of reminders. And there's a lot of really fun nuance in there. Like when you create a new event, it uses your last event settings. So it kind of assumes that you want to do it the same way. But there's a lot of really smart defaults and like handling the way it should be set up. And it's all just like super straightforward, an index of reminders, and you create a new reminder. And I was just super proud of how it came off, because my initial kind of forays into this, and this is one of the things for me, it's like prototyping to learn. It was tip 16 in the book. And it was one of those things that, like on the back of the napkin, I tied this like column of reminders to an event. And I was just like, once I started prototyping it, I was just like, no, I need its own controller for event reminders, its own view. And it became its own object with object types. And then there's inheritance. So it's an SMS reminder, it's an email reminder, but there's shared logic and view. And it's just super clean. And I don't think if I had taken the time to prototype before passing it off to the other devs and back and forth with a client, you know, I don't think I would have found those objects that were hiding in there and found that controller and interface to be able to split it in such like a simple view. And it really turned out awesome.
Totally. Yeah. I think there's a lot to say about prototyping to learn. And I was just going to mention one thing I thought I've found super, super helpful in this like prototype to learn thing, because I also am working on like another project, just like an app for my like my barber. So just like the app that they use to manage all their clients and scheduling and all these other typical things that you might find in like a CRM, for example. Is I'm still like in this prototype phase where like even my repository is like says like prototype in it. And I've just been,
you still haven't made that jump to the actual project yet.
Yeah. I haven't even get in it in a different like Rails new app. But like I've been leaning so hardcore on the scaffold generator, like literally Rails G scaffold model. And then I throw a bunch of things in it. And I am like so happy that I'm like competent enough in Rails to like understand what's going on under the hood, because like when I generate a scaffold, I know how to like fuck with it in the right ways. I don't know. It's not like totally breaking my brain. But at the same time, I think it's amazing because it forces you to think in like in a cruddy way, so that everything is just like a resource. Because I found myself, I was messing with the idea of like an activity logger. So it would be like, it would log different sort of activities on an appointment, that you might schedule. And
so kind of like an audit log against the appointment
right,
object.
Right, exactly. Yeah. And so I started writing like my own controllers, because I was like, oh, there has to be like a verify for the appointment check-in time or something like that. I forgot what it was, but I like started writing like define verify as like a controller, and then I was like, okay.
Oh, no, no, no.
And then I started writing another one that was like confirm or something like that, and I was like, what am I doing here? And it's like, so then I like scrapped all of that, and then I just like Rails G scaffold and then like whatever that object was, and I was like, this makes my life so much easier, because now I just have like a resource that's like restful, it's cruddy, it's like everything I need it to be. I don't have to do like some random things. And at the end of the day, like that's probably what it's going to end up being. And it's great, man. You should see my like migration. I have like so many different migrations because I've like fucked up columns. I don't need these columns anymore. but a cool thing is you can like Rails D migration. No, you could do Rails D scaffold and then the model name, and then it will like delete everything that it generated for you, including like all the SAS files, the helpers, like everything in that folder. Dude, it's an amazing like prototype tool. I think like Rails
G scaffold. Dude, that's a hot tip. I didn't know that one.
I know, seriously, because like I had messed with like one of the scaffolds that I had generated, and I did like a bunch of like form objects on it, and I like did a bunch of shit with it. I messed with the views, and I was like, I don't want any of this anymore. Like, how can I undo that? You just like Rails D. Rails D scaffold the resource, it takes out like the line in the routes file, like everything for you, and it's like, I don't know, just such a great way to prototype things, because it's like, yeah. I'll just throw this away at the end of the day, and I have like a good skeleton of like what the app needs to be moving forward. I don't know, just such a great tool. I don't know, I've never thought
that's interesting. Yeah, I've never thought of it that way, because scaffolding to me is like something that I use for, you know, like literally bullshit. I don't ever use it for anything. I mean, maybe if I'm like trying to teach someone, we'll generate a scaffold just to like show everything there and the best conventions. But I really like your idea of using it as kind of a prototype, use it as a way to just kind of hash. And it's super cool. Like you said, it forces you to be really restful, which is really great. And that's kind of what I was saying, that prototype helps you pull out those objects in those nouns and those different objects so much better. One of the tips that really stood out to me, and we've mentioned it before, but this idea of not leaving broken windows. And so I've been, over the past few months, actually pretty much through this book, I've been very much scaling my operations as kind of an independent dev firm and hiring on contractors who are more consistent and working with me a lot. I mean, for all practical purposes, they're employees, but they're 1099 just to make things simpler. When I had my first contractor start up, I mean, my code base had like 3 failing tests. And very quickly, having another contractors, 1 and then 2 contractors, that very quickly went up to like 16, 17 failing tests. Every PR, I had failing tests. And I kind of like, we had a Slack touchdown. I was just like, okay, no broken windows. We're going to enforce this policy of zero tolerance on tests. Absolutely everything has to be green every time. There's not going to be like, oh, I know these are failing, but we know why. It's on this other PR. No, there's no more. Like, we're going to get this green and we're going to do it, and we're going to do it within a week. And so once we did that, it's been weeks now, months now, actually, it's been well over a month. Everything has stayed green. And the idea of keeping them all green has been so much easier when there isn't one that's red. But 3 turned to 12, 16 so quickly because it's already there. It's like when there's the dirty dish in the sink and you're just like, ah, fuck it. There's already dirty dishes. I'll throw it in. But when there's none in there, you don't put that dirty dish in the sink. You're not going to be the first person to break that.
Yeah, exactly. That's crazy that it just multiplied like that. And I guess if I was like a contractor coming on too, I'd be like, fuck it. There's already failing tests. Like, whatever. One thing, I'm going to switch context really quick and segue into one topic that I wanted to discuss that I guess deserves a little bit of talking about. And it's just the first tip of the book, and it's like caring about your craft. So like that was like the first thing that was ever like mentioned, and then a lot of it just became about like be pragmatic with how you program and tease things into objects and test often and all this stuff. But I think there's a lot to say about programming as a craft. And I actually, like, I guess I take this like very seriously. Like, to me, programming and coding is not just, I mean, a lot of it is like solving business problems, sure. But I try very hard to like hone programming as a craft, like every single day. And that's just like, whether it's like filling in my gaps of knowledge of like how SQL queries should be written, because I feel like sometimes my active record queries are like total garbage and I end up in Ruby land when I could just be in SQL land.
Sure.
Or like, you know, just like practicing algorithms and stuff. I mean, you know, Rome wasn't built in a day, so obviously like this has to be like incremental, small little contributions that eventually snowball into being a really good craftsperson. I don't know. I just thought I wanted to bring light to it, because obviously like not every programmer, not every developer, not every engineer has to like really love what they do as a craft. I think it's totally fine to just do it for like for the money or because like you need to provide for your family. But for me, I see it as something that like, even when I retire, I feel like I'm still going to be doing this stuff just for fun, like my own projects without having to like deal with like deadlines. It's just going to be like shit that I want to build. Maybe I'll have like a bunch of side projects that never end up getting complete, but at least I won't have the pressure of having to complete something. It's just like something that I want to be very, very good at. I don't know.
Yeah. I couldn't agree more. I really want to be good at programming as a craft. Right now, my focus is really Ruby on Rails and going deep on that. But I really want to go deeper. For me, I feel like the direction I want to be just absolute expert in is like defining domain and structuring a thought system and a business system in a way that's implementable from a software standpoint, regardless of code. Because there's just, to me, it's so exciting to start figuring out what those objects are and how they interact, regardless of actually how they're exactly implemented on the front end. And that's where I'm more focusing than the actual codesmithing, although I do enjoy that part as well. But for me, it's like a bigger piece of design thinking overall, and not necessarily UI or UX, but almost systems architecture that to me I find just so interesting, and that I just really want to be expert at and own that space of just being able to simplify a problem and distill it back and define it down. And to me, that's what gets really exciting. But as that craft as a whole, which programming fits into that, design fits into that, UI, all these different things, I really try to hone my skill daily, reading books, doing all I can to do my own exercises and challenges outside of the code base, and even just on client and daily work, solving it in novel ways that are a challenge, because it's easy to just get comfortable and like, oh yeah, I could ship this feature. I could check the boxes here, or I could check the boxes in a way, fulfill the requirements in a way that's a lot more exciting and a lot more stimulating and a lot more interesting from a software perspective, and solve it in ways that are different. You know, I will do with form objects this time, not just a standard REST view. I'll do it in different ways and use different tools and really try to, and this is another thing that I try to do. I try to, as much as possible, interact with, you know, whether it be informally or formally, with people who are much better trained and experienced than me. And so I actually, every 2 weeks, I meet with someone who's just like, I think he's like a 7 or 8 year Rails developer, expert level above me, senior Rails dev, and he just comes in and tears apart the code I've written the last 2 weeks. And it's just been absolutely so insightful to have someone with that type of deep Rails thinking to be able to kind of hone my code, hone my thinking, and provide that challenging. Because especially as an independent developer, it's easy to get comfortable, log the hours, ship the feature, and get paid. And I feel like there's so much more to be had if you own your craft. Because I agree with you. It's like sometimes you have to pay the bills. Sometimes you don't love the current project or company you're working on. And that's fine. But I think you can treat every challenge as an opportunity to grow your skill set and be something that you're proud of and really proud to be a programmer. And that's something that I really look at. I look at it as a crafts, like a tradesman, like someone who's an ancient woodworker or a painter. Like I really see it that way. And I really see it something that should be respected. And we're really at the beginning of this. Like, in a lot of ways, it's exciting because this whole craft, I could only imagine what it looks like 100 years from today, what a computer programmer looks like. I mean, it's going to be worlds different than it is today.
Yeah, totally. Like, there's definitely something to say about not just like being a computer programmer, but also like someone who could design software really well. And that's like also something that I think is like super important, super interesting. Yeah, you know, when you put it like that, it's crazy to think that we're sort of at the beginning of it. It's like you see something like Game of Thrones, right, which is supposed to be a representation of like the olden times, and you see people like making swords and like welding and stuff like that. You don't see like people hacking away at software. So it's like it just sort of puts into perspective like how we are at like the forefront of things. We're like leading the charge of, you know. Which is crazy to me because you see these like really thick textbooks that are like decades old and you're like, oh, wow, I'm like so late to it and there's all these things. But, you know, who knows what, you know, 100 years from now is going to look like when it comes to, you know, engineering software.
Yeah. I mean, even if you look at just the lifespan of JavaScript, I mean, when did actual cross-browser, when could you guarantee that users could have JavaScript turned on? 4 years ago? Not even. And at this point, everything is built in JavaScript and you can 100% depend on JavaScript. But JavaScript, that's what I'm saying. Like, it's so new as a language. It's like 4 years old that you could depend on someone's browser actually having JavaScript enabled, maybe five at most. Like, that's how early this is. You're 5 years into an entire new trade, which is just incredible to be at the early stages here. I mean, 10 years ago, we weren't even barely using JavaScript in the browser. I mean, it just wasn't really there. 20 years ago, it was completely non-existent. And I could only imagine what 10 years from now looks like for app and mobile development, web development. It's really exciting to think about what that looks like and being like the old timer around, which is just, that idea is so weird to me.
Yeah, you know, it's so crazy to think how far browsers have come themselves in the last 10 years. I remember it was for sure at least 10 years ago, when like PNG support wasn't supported by every browser. And so like, if you want, cause I used to be part of like all these like forums and stuff, before like Reddit, I guess. And like,
yeah, sure.
You would have like signatures and stuff. And it would always be like a cool thing to have like a transparent background so that like your graphic would like pop out and it would look like it's coming out of the page. But PNG support wasn't there for every browser. And so like, instead of showing like transparent pixels, it would show this like really weird light blue background. And I was just like, oh man, this is so crazy. And then I remember like, you know, 5-6 years after that, when I was like starting to like really just dabble with HTML and stuff, I was like, oh, I can't use a PNG here. I have to like use a really shitty GIF and like, it'll get me that transparency I want, but it's going to be like really hard around the edges.
Really low res. Yeah. I remember that too. That's so funny. And I remember like trying to figure out the color code of the forum background so that I could then have it like look like it's transparent, because it would be at least be consistent on the browsers. Yeah. It's amazing how far we've come so fast and how long the road is in front of us, because the amount of industries that have been disrupted and like businesses using software just grows exponentially every single day. And there's just so much of an exciting future in front of us. And I can't wait to be there to build it all. It's awesome.
Yeah, totally.
So kind of on yours, I really liked that tip as well, care about your craft. But another one was tip 66 really stood out to me, which is find bugs once. And it's this idea of this extra care. I feel like it is kind of in the same vein of really caring about what you're doing. The idea of finding bugs once. And so I think it was like 2 weeks ago or so, Sunday, 4 p.m., the founder texts me about a bug about on the site. And so I jump on my laptop and I write a quick fix, right? Hop on the couch. I'm like, oh, I got this. I grab a LaCroix and I'm like, I'm going to fix this bug in like 20 minutes, right? So I solve it for that record. I find the bug where it's there. It's some UI bug. I'm like, okay, this is easy. I've got it solved. Push the changes. Just, you know, git master push. Fuck it. I got it. I don't need to write new tests on this. Okay. But then what ended up happening is for every other record but that one, pretty much, probably 80% of the records, then was broken. So it went from 2% of the records being broken on Vue to 80% of the records being broken on Vue. So I fixed the one record but broke all the others. And so I left the whole situation worse than before. And it's something that I've already learned this lesson, but for some reason I didn't learn it that weekend and I just got cocky in the moment. And so it's just the idea of that when you get an error or a bug in from users, you're going to write the test, have it fail, build the fix, and all the tests are green. And it's so simple, but to me, a huge takeaway that saved me so much energy and stress and problems when I do follow it. And I definitely, I think that's the last time that I'll ever not, regardless of the rush or how much of an emergency it is. You can always take an extra 15, 20 minutes, 30, an hour, 2 hours. You can always take it to write the test to make sure you're fixing it correctly. Even if the site's down, for real, you can take the time to fix it right, because you will end up in a situation, because we're human and you can't keep the whole system in your head, you'll end up in a situation where you fix it worse than you had it before.
Yeah, you know, I have like varying opinions on TDD, because like I don't think TDD is always necessary all the time. As long as you have test coverage, that's like fine. Now I know there's a bunch of like hardcore TDDers out there that like only build features with TDD. Good for them. That's like that's like amazing. I just couldn't personally do that, but I do think in the case where like there is a known bug, I think the first step is to definitely like write the test that like, okay, this is what's failing. Like if you can replicate that error in a test, that's like the jumping off point. And then like you'll know for sure that the bug is fixed and that you've squished it when like that test is green and then your whole test suite's green. I think like that is like the perfect use case for TDD. Like I think in fact you should TDD those cases, because like, I don't know, like how do you know if you're actually like fixing things if you're not writing the test that fails? Cool. Do you have any picks this week?
I do have a pick. If you have a pick, if not, then I won't embarrass you by having a pick if you don't have one.
No, I could think of one. Just go first and then I'll think of one.
Okay, sounds good. So I've been using actually for a really long time, and I realized this week when I was using it that this is a really good pick for the show. It's called Hemingway App, and it's hemingwayapp.com, and it actually helps you write better English. And so what I do is pretty much everything I write, especially marketing copy, goes into this website. And essentially what it does is it highlights things in different colors, and like it'll give you yellow for it's like this sentence is hard to read. It'll give you red if it's very hard to read. It highlights adverbs, so like helpfully or perhaps, and then things like just like simpler alternatives. So a word like utilize, it'll make a recommendation for use. So instead of using the word utilize, use the word use. And so it helps you avoid these kind of pretentious and high-minded sounding words. But the whole goal and like the overall thing that I really love about it is it gives you a readability score and a grade score on that readability. And oftentimes my first pass on things is like a 10th grade reading level, meaning a lot of the sentences are kind of hard to read. I'm using kind of pretentious words and longer words than I need to. A lot of adverbs, so like, you know, helpfully or things like that are just like all those types of words that are less direct. And so the whole goal of the app is to help you write really clearly and directly. And I try to rewrite everything to be like grade 4 or grade 5, like the simplest, especially marketing copy, but even like client emails. When I'm describing something that's a complicated issue, it's a really, really good tool to have short, simple sentences. I couldn't recommend it more. It's been awesome.
Yeah, I'm checking it out now. It's cool. It's funny that like you want to have a lower grade level. One thing it doesn't have support for is it doesn't correct you on less and fewer, which is like one of my biggest grammar Nazi things.
I love it. Awesome. What's your pick?
So my pick this week, I don't know if I've talked about Better Touch Tool, but I paid for this software. And basically what it lets you do is it makes your Macintosh fucking kick ass. So I'm like very big on Home Row, which is the reason that I like really like using Vim and Tmux, even though in my day-to-day, I like just use Atom. I have Vim key binding, so I'm still cool. But I use Better Touch Tool, and I have a bunch of like key modifiers to make it so that I can like navigate through my spaces just using like HJKL or like Control plus HJKL. And there's just like you can basically any like sequence of or like touches or presses, you can map to like whatever you want. You can make like, I don't know, I'm really cool, type really fast, open up Spotify. I don't know. In theory, that's what you could do. But I have a bunch of things that make it so that like I can switch my spaces. I can like display all the windows. I have it so that like tapping shift twice will bring up like the emoji keyboard, so I don't have to do the stupid like control command spacebar thing.
Cool. Well, thank you so much for listening. We are excited to be closing out this book. So this is kind of the end of The Pragmatic Programmer. We will have an update in the feed soon on what our next book looks like, but we're actually going to be taking about 2 weeks off between this and our next book, and we will see you for chapter one of our next book, and we'll make sure that you guys know that both in the feed, on Twitter, and everywhere else. We'll be updating what the next book is. So thank you, everyone devoted, and thank you so much, and we will see you next season. And I guess in the meantime, this is a good time to say, please spread the show, tweet about it. It really helps us a lot. Even just one tweet and those two or three of your friends or five or six or thousands of your friends who see that is super helpful to just get our show and get it out there. And we really appreciate that. Reviews and any of the listeners, you know, if you're on Spotify or Apple Podcasts or wherever, if you drop us a review in there, it really goes a long way. And we really appreciate that. Thanks so much for listening. And we will see you guys in a couple weeks.
See ya.